20 years ago, my husband and I arrived in New York City so he could pursue his PhD. We were in New York, so I wanted to work on Wall Street. But as a music major, having never set foot in an accounting, finance, or economics course, I started as a secretary. With a lot of hard work and a little luck, I eventually was able to move up the Wall Street food chain to an investment banker. Later, I took a step back to become an equity analyst. 8 years later, at the top of my game, I quit that job with plans to publish a children's book and produce a TV show, but ended up blogging about discovering and pursuing your dreams and starting a hedge fund with Clayton Christensen. My career path has been unusual, but perhaps that's the new normal. The idea of a company man or woman has actually long been outdated. Since 1983, median job tenure in the United States is 5 years. Baby boomers have held 11 jobs on average, while the percentages of people that stay at a job longer than 10 and 20 years have declined substantially. A career change isn't as easily documented because a job switch is harder to define, but the research suggests it's becoming increasingly common and case studies abound. It may be difficult to make sense of these seemingly wanton but ultimately satisfying career moves until you consider the theory of disruptive innovation. For those of you unfamiliar with this terminology, disruptive innovation is a term coined by Clayton Christensen to describe a low-end or new market innovation that eventually upends an industry. For example, a disruptor, think about the Japanese or Korean automakers. They start at the low end of the market, and then in the pursuit of profit, they gradually produce higher performance, higher margin products. The established competitors, like the US automakers, could aggressively defend against these low-end disruptors, but it doesn't make financial sense to defend against their least, or to defend their least profitable products, but instead they flee up market, until of course it does make sense, and then it's too late. There are volumes of research indicating that the odds of success improve for companies, even countries, when you pursue a disruptive path. I believe that harnessing this powerful mindset of disruption actually begins with the individual. Companies don't disrupt, people do. That doesn't mean that everybody needs to abandon the traditional path. You may be pursuing an ambitious goal like winning a C-suite job, in which case disruption isn't necessary. Simply stay the course. But if you feel like you've plateaued or you won't be happy at the top rung of the ladder, then you may want to disrupt yourself for the same reason that companies must. Sometimes it's to head off the competition. What you do well, even brilliantly, will eventually be done by a cheaper, more nimble version of you. But when it comes to personal disruption, there's an even more important factor because compensation isn't just financial, psychological and social factors also matter. You may be thinking, I want to disrupt myself. I want the rewards that personal disruption will bring, but I have no idea what my dream is. What would I disrupt myself for? When I took my sabbatical from Wall Street in 2005, in part, the motivation was my children. I wanted to spend more time focusing on the art of mothering. My children were 9 and 5 respectively, and I wanted to be more a part of their growing up. Once I was no longer working 80 plus hours a week, I was also able to spend more time talking to the mothers of my children's friends. These were bright, interesting, intelligent women, and I found myself asking them, "What's your dream?" Frequently, they would say to me, "I don't have a dream. I don't know how to do my dream." And often, there was an unspoken, "I'm not sure it's my privilege to dream." This concerned and saddened me. I saw such wonderful possibilities in these supremely capable women. I needed to do something. I had to build a case for dreaming. I considered writing a book, but no agent would have paid me mind, and so I made the decision to take the low-end, low-margin approach to securing a toehold in publishing, and I started a blog. My blog, which I called Dare to Dream, was a forum for discussing why it's our privilege to dream, how to make our dreams happen, and also a place where women could share the stories of their dreams. I also found that as they started to share the stories of their dreams, they were able to answer that elusive question, "What is my dream?" by remembering what they loved to do as children. In fact, that is a gateway to our disruptive path. Athelia Woolley, for example, loved fashion as a child. But she didn't know how to sew, so she set that dream aside. Until, of course, she graduated with a master's degree in social work, and she got so sick that she couldn't work a 9-to-5 job, nor could she work and travel abroad, which were her other dreams. As she took stock of what she could do, she recalled her childhood love of fashion. She found herself considering the prospect of starting an online retailer. This was 2005. Today, Shabby Apple is on track to generate over $1 million in revenue. Said Louise Driscoll, within your heart, keep one still spot where your dreams may go. I don't know what your dream is, but what I do know is that it is your privilege to dream and to do your very own dream. I also know that only dreamers can disrupt. And whether at the organizational or individual level, we all seem to follow four basic rules. And for your consideration, rule number one, disruptors target a need that can be met more effectively. Customers don't actually buy products, they hire them to fulfill a need. Disruptors look for needs that aren't being met effectively in places where no one wants to play or has thought of playing. A great example of this is Salesforce.com, a simple, inexpensive, cloud-based CRM software that initially targeted small and medium-sized businesses, and then in the pursuit of profit, moved up market and now is challenging market leaders such as SAP. A personal example of this is Meredith Perry. As an undergrad at Penn, she went to class one day with a dead laptop and no power cord. Shouldn't you be able to charge wireless devices wirelessly, she thought? Perry, a former NASA intern, set out to solve this problem. Using information from Google and Wikipedia, she built a working prototype of a transmitter that uses ultrasonic waves in order to charge wireless devices wirelessly. I don't understand it either, don't worry. But I think it's really cool. She recently received $750,000 in funding for her company, UBeam. Rule number two, identify your disruptive strengths. When you're looking for needs to meet, make sure those needs match what you do well, meaning your distinctive strengths. Focusing on market risk, places and things that no one else has tried rather than competitive risk. For example, America Mobile, one of the world's largest wireless companies, instead of skirmishing with wireline incumbent Telmex, for the 20 million people who could afford a landline, they went after the 80 million people that couldn't. Adam Richardson was working as an industrial engineer at Sun Microsystems in the 90s when he discovered that very few of his fellow engineers understood customer needs and could design to those needs. Adam wasn't the strongest stylist, but he was enthralled by market research and good at capturing it. He eventually veered from the traditional path to study anthropology, sociology, cultural theory, disciplines that all now form the bedrock of his research or work that blends design with customer insights. As a disruptor, don't just look at what you do well, look at what you do well that others don't. Rule number three. Step back or sideways in order to grow. When organizations get too big, they sometimes stop exploring smaller opportunities because the resulting revenue won't impact the bottom line enough. Just as Borders was slow to embrace e-commerce, people can allow themselves to plateau. We avoid that by jumping to a new curve. For example, Dave Blakely. He started as an engineer at IDEO 20 years ago. He volunteered to become a project manager early on. He could have worked his way up to manage technical staff, but he volunteered to become a project manager. Many of his peers dismissed this as an escape route from the rigor and detail of engineering. But by taking this backward step, he broadened his skills and began to climb a new ladder. Today, he's the head of technology strategy. Heather Coughlin gave up an equity sales VP position at Goldman Sachs in order to help launch Hudson Street, an independent research firm. Coughlin got in on the ground floor not only because she thought demand for independent research would grow, but also because she thought her need for personal growth could be met more effectively in a startup environment. Many thought it ill-advised to leave her comfortable perch, but the operating skills that she acquired in building and operating Hudson Street are what propelled her into a biz dev role at Isis Parenting and ultimately the CEO seat. Isis Parenting is a company that focuses on education for parents of newborns. A heart-wrenching but ultimately uplifting story of taking a step back in order to move forward is that of photographer Lenola Kathleen Stone. After years of waiting to find the right man, she married only to find that he was emotionally and physically abusive. As she stayed in the marriage, the images in her mind and heart that had always informed her gift of photography, they vanished. Ending the marriage felt like a frightening step back for her, but once she said no to abuse, the beautiful images began to reappear. Lenola recently had a dream fulfilled with the publication of her first book. Sometimes we need to take a step back or sideways in order to move forward, and sometimes those steps turn into slingshots. Rule number four, let your strategy emerge. As disruptors, we're in search of a yet-to-be-defined market, so we can't know the opportunity at the outset. We need to let our strategy emerge. Rather than performing a detailed-by-detailed analysis, plotting out step-by-step how we're going to achieve our goal, we need to take a step forward, gather feedback, adapt accordingly, which means you'll likely end up in a place you hadn't anticipated. You won't be alone. According to Amar Bede, 70% of all successful new businesses end up with a strategy different from the one they initially pursued. 70%. An example of this is Millennium Pharmaceuticals. Millennium started out as a boutique company focused on genetics. They then added genomics, drug discovery, clinical trials, and after being public for 10 years, they were acquired by Takeda as an oncology company. No one could have expected or anticipated how Millennium would evolve over those years. A personal example of an emergent strategy is that of Sabina Nawaz. Sabina was moving quickly up the ranks at Microsoft, probably positioning herself for a coveted VP role, when she received positive reviews about her management skills. So she decided to disrupt herself, asking to move into a human resources role where she worked for 7 years. Then, rather than continuing to climb at Microsoft, she left to start a leadership development consultancy. This was never her career ambition, but she let her strategy emerge. Could Sabina Nawaz have known when she arrived in Boston to study software engineering that she would end up in Washington State running a leadership development consultancy? When I left Merrill Lynch, I thought I was leaving forever. I could never have foreseen that I'd start a hedge fund. We all like to make plans for the future, but following a disruptive path requires a willingness to pivot and to not be able to see the end from the beginning. Nor can we rely on the predictability of simple cause and effect. Flip the switch and the light goes on. Just as the S-curve helps us understand how quickly an innovation will be adopted, it also helps us understand personal disruption. For example, whether you're building a business or learning to play tennis or probably even parenting, when you first start, initially progress will be quite slow. Knowing this from S-curve math actually helps us keep discouragement at bay. As we practice, we accelerate into competence. Once we approach mastery, the less we enjoy the feel-good effects of learning, and boredom can kick in. As our learning crests, if we don't jump to a new curve, we may actually precipitate our own decline, and I don't necessarily mean a financial downfall, but our emotional well-being may take a hit. As Saul Kaplan said, my life has been about searching for the steep learning curve because that's where I do my best work. When I do my best work, money and stature have always followed. In other words, forget the plateau of profits, seek and scale a learning curve. Now, don't mistake me. Personal disruption is by definition scary and lonely. I know, you're thinking, if disruption is scary and lonely and unpredictable and I have to part with my current standing and swim against the tide, why would I disrupt myself? Because somewhere in the deepest part of you, you know you must. And if you don't, you'll die inside a little. Hence what we call the innovator's dilemma. But there's also a business case for it. When you pursue a disruptive course, you may still fail, but the odds of success are 6 times higher and the revenue opportunity 20 times greater. And I'd like to let you in on a secret that is not well enough known. Women are great disruptors. In conducting research, trying to understand why women were able to change jobs more readily than men, Professor Boris Groysberg discovered that women build networks outside of an organization that remain intact when they leave. They don't build these networks on purpose, but because they are frequently marginalized, left out of the internal power structure, they build external networks out of necessity, meaning they learn to play where no one wants to play or no one has thought of playing. If you want to unleash a disruptive edge, hire a woman. If you want to build a disruptive company, found a women-led company. If you're an investor, invest in women. Follow the lead of Super Angel Dave McClure, who said, "I intend to corner the market on women founders. If there is any bias whatsoever, I plan to selfishly take advantage of that." With a nod to former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, if you want to disrupt, go ask a woman. To conclude, I'd like to share a poem with you by Mary Oliver. "One day you knew what you had to do, and you began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds. And there was a new voice which you slowly recognized as your own that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, doing the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save." We give a lot of airtime to building and buying disruptive companies. Well, we should, but the fundamental unit of disruption is ultimately the individual. If you really want to move you, your business, and the world forward, innovate on the inside and dare to disrupt yourself. Thank you. We now have a lot of time, and so I will be happy to take questions. And you probably weren't expecting this. And so if someone, you know what? Just going to raise the ante here. If someone will be brave enough to ask the first question, I will give you a free book. All right, here we go. I knew it. Okay. You in the green, lime green.
So, as we talk about disrupting ourselves, do you see opportunities to disrupt yourself within your own organization? I work for a very large company, there are lots of different career avenues. Do you have perspective on the advantages of how you can disrupt yourself and recreate a new path within your existing organization, and what are the barriers to it?
Yes. The question is, if you're in a large company, can you actually disrupt yourself? One of the examples that I presented to you, but I didn't make it quite clear enough, is that of Dave Blakely. He's been at IDEO for 20 years, and he disrupted himself by, rather than working his way up to manage technical staff, he volunteered to become a project manager. As I mentioned, however, some perceive that as an escape route from engineering. So I do think that there are sometimes barriers because there's that internal perception that you are taking a step back or potentially even going on a mommy track, if you will. What I think has to happen in that particular instance, well, one of two things. One is that it's really important to be communicating with your senior manager and having a discussion around what you are trying to do and accomplish and where you'd like to go and strategically what you're trying to make happen. So you need a couple of sponsors in the organization and to cultivate that early on. The second thing I would say is there are going to be some organizations that won't let you do that. I know for me, while I was on Wall Street as an equity analyst, I got to a point where I wanted to continue to rise, and they said, no, you're doing a terrific job where you are. I wouldn't have known it then, but I think it was kind of the glass ceiling. So sometimes what you'll have to do is understand that you can plot this, you can be strategic, you can talk to senior management, tell them what you're trying to do and what the overall game plan is, and sometimes you'll have to end up leaving if you want to really move your career forward. So a lot of it goes to making sure you hire the right manager when you go to work at a company. Okay, come find me later for your book. Okay. Okay, please go ahead.
Talk a little bit more about how to get in touch with your dreams.
Oh, Well, okay, I'm happy to repeat the question. So her question is, she'd like to know a little bit more about how to get in touch with your dreams. It's a great question. There are a couple things that we can do. Sometimes we think that our dreams are actually over the rainbow, but it turns out that they're frequently right under our feet. One of the things that I like to ask, and I alluded to in the presentation, is what did you like to do as a child? It's a great question because it helps you kind of piece together what maybe you'd love to do, because children don't do what they don't want to do. Well, they do, but not really. Under duress, they do. But when they're left to their own devices, they really do what they want to do. Another thing that you can start to figure out what your dream is look at what you do reflexively well. Things that people compliment you on and you kind of brush them off and think, it's not a big deal. Well, it's probably not a big deal because you do it so astonishingly well that you don't even notice it anymore. That's something that makes you feel strong, and you want to try to make sure that you tap into that as you're looking at your dream. The other thing is look at some of those things that are acquired competencies. Sometimes we end up being very good at something, not because we set out to. For example, I'm pretty good at getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning. It's not that I said, I want to be good at this, but just throughout my life, whether it was to practice the piano or to get up to go to seminary or go to work, I got up at 6 a.m. Well, now I've got that discipline of being able to get up early in the morning, or I've learned to build a financial model. Trust that those competencies that you've developed, that you've spent years developing, may very well be important to you as you dream. And then the third thing I would mention, and there's a lot of this in the book, is that it's important to think about what are your deeply held beliefs, because we do dream within the context of what we believe. And one of the ways, you're probably looking at me thinking, well, I don't know, what do I believe? Well, a good way to figure that out is to make a list of 5 of the quotes that you love, that you've thought of, you've maybe hung on your wall, that you've shared them with people over the years. Those are really good guideposts of what your deeply held beliefs are. And I'll give you an example of one of mine. We'll see if anybody knows who it is. You can bet your life and that, and twice its double, that God knew exactly where he wanted you to be placed. Anybody? Okay. One day someone's going to know who that quote is. It's Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life. So now there's some nodding heads. It's from, you know what? I know. You know what? I so wish I could sing, but it's not one of my innate talents or my acquired competencies. It is something I long for, but I think it's what in the department of the Mirror of Erised from Harry Potter. It will never happen. Okay. Next question. Yes, please.
How do you pass the fear of failure in trying to disrupt?
Question is, how do you pass the fear of failure in trying to disrupt? That's something I've thought about a lot recently. A couple of answers. Number one is that sometimes when we're afraid of something, that's actually a really helpful signpost for us, because if we're afraid, it means that we care, that this is something that we actually want. And so that's a very helpful piece, a useful piece of information for us to have. The other thing is, I would say, is that whenever you are daring, you are by definition daring to fail. If you think about the cycle, you've got the process of wanting to accomplish a dream. You dare, you do, you fail, learn. And as you're doing, there are a lot of things that you learn, but there are some, you're bound to fail at some level. But it doesn't have to be a millstone if you can pull the shame out of it, that sense of, I am bad, I failed because I am bad. Instead, look at it very clinically and think, I just learned something new. Okay, now I'm going to get up and dare again, and I'm going to do. And then I've got this cycle that allows me to move up the S-curve of competence. So it's not easy. But I think that part of it is really understanding that dreaming is a process. And if we are, and I know from personal experience that sometimes we experience shame and we think, well, it didn't work because I'm a bad person. If we can start to pull that out of the equation, then we'll dare again and we'll keep doing, and so we'll move on through the process. Okay. Okay, yes, please. The question is, I'm chuckling, the question is, what is the difference between chaos and disruption? Chaos is chaos. And disruption I think some of us think of that term disruption in the sense of, I remember when I was in seventh grade, I had a pencil that I would bang on my desk to see how much I could agitate my teacher and have her send me to the office because I was going through my 12-year-old rebellious stage. But that's not what you're talking, what we're talking about. Disruption in this particular sense is a term of art. It is disruptive innovation, which is a process by which you go into the low end of the market and then eventually move up market. So as a term of art, it's a very different thing. Yes, please. Yes.
So I know there's sometimes a lot of discipline and planning in terms of that. So can you talk a little bit more about the do aspect?
Absolutely. The question is, you spent a lot of time talking about dare and dream, but can you talk a little bit more about the do? The do part, a couple of tips there. First of all, one of the things I think that sometimes we struggle with is that once we may have a couple of dreams. We may have four or five dreams that seem pretty interesting to us, and we think, oh, I can't start. Well, here's where, even if you are in a very committed relationship, it's time to start dating. You can date dreams. There can be a no commitment clause. You don't have to marry all the dreams. And when I say date dreams, I mean there may be a dream that you date for 5 minutes. And then you looked some stuff up on the internet, like, I want to be a world-class athlete, and you realize, oh, actually, I don't really. And so you move on to the next dream. So first of all, I would say on the doing is figure out what dream you want to do, but you don't have to commit until you're really ready to do it. That's number one. Number two, dreaming is actually a discovery-driven process. As I mentioned earlier, you need to let your strategy emerge. When it comes to dreaming, a conventional planning checklist, I'm going to wake up in the morning, have 10 things I'm going to accomplish, and make that dream happen, you got to throw that out. This is very much a discovery-driven. You take a step forward, you gather feedback, you adapt accordingly, you take another step forward. And so trust the fact that you're not going to be able to see the end from the beginning. So that's step number two. Number three, break it up into really, really, really small pieces, because when you start to get to a dream, if there's any fear involved, perfectionism kicks in. And I don't know about you, but I unfortunately am very good friends with perfectionism. I wish I were not. So what I do is I'll break it down into very, very small pieces. So for example, I have a piece that I need to write or a project that I need to do at work that I'm overwhelmed by. I'll say, okay, all I have to do is sit down at my table for 5 minutes, figure out what I need to get done, and then I can leave. Well, guess what? It's a hack, right? Because you trick yourself into starting. So again, start in really, really, really small increments. And then the fourth tip, I think I'm on number four, is embrace the idea of bootstrapping. Embrace your constraints. Sometimes we think, I will accomplish my dream if only I can get funding, if only I can get a babysitter, if only I can get a house cleaner, if only, if only, if only. But the reality is that the constraints that we have, apart from the fact that they're just a reality of life, as we embrace our constraints, they do two things. Number one, they force us to make choices. And choices, even though we don't like them, are actually very important. They're very important. And as we have constraints, we're required to sort of dig around and root around us to find what skills and competencies and people that we know that can help us make our dream happen that we wouldn't have if we could have just sort of thrown money or time at it. So our constraints also require us to become more innovative. And it's likely, I mean, almost every person that really innovates and starts a new business, they were trying to solve a problem. They had a constraint. They needed to figure it out. Okay. Yes, purple.
Mm-hmm.
that's cohesive. All right, the question is, what do you do when you're doing lots of different things? I'm going to extrapolate a little bit here. You've been involved with the PTA. You've done some part-time work on this. You're doing lots of different things, and now you're ready to go out and interview for a job at a corporation. How do you frame this so that it comes across as cohesive, that it's stated in such a way that people who tend to be linear thinkers can look at it and go, wow, this is really impressive and awesome? Did I frame that correctly? Yeah? Okay. So what I would say is knowing that you're talking to an audience that tends to see things in a linear fashion, I think is very helpful, is to try to sit in their shoes and figure out a way to make a narrative that they as the audience can understand. The other thing I would say, there's some specific helps. There's an organization called iRelaunch, which some of you may have heard of. They're specifically targeted to women who have been out of the workforce and want to relaunch, and they are very, very helpful in helping you think through how to position yourself to re-enter the workforce. And so whether or not you're re-entering, I think they can be very helpful. Like, one of the first things they say is, you know, get a LinkedIn profile. Then they do some really clever things, which I think are fantastic. Sometimes, you know, women will feel like, well, I'm too old. She said, well, you say to them, you know what? Aren't you lucky? I've already had all of my children. I'm not going to need maternity leave. Aren't you happy? You know, so there's some ways that you can reframe things. And so what I would say to you specifically, if you want a tactical help, is look at iRelaunch. Okay. Yes, please. Oh, it's called iRelaunch, so I and then just R-E-L-A-U-N-C-H, and you can Google it and you'll find it. Yes, in the back. Okay, I can't hear you. The fear? Yeah. Okay. Right, okay. So the question is, you know you want to disrupt yourself. You've been doing something for 26 years, and you just can't get past the fear. What do you do? Well, you may just have to do it, because you know. But besides that, one of the things that we talk about in disruptive innovation theory is that we know that there's something that we're already doing that we're really, really good at, and we want to jump to a new curve. And it's like that leap that we have to make is just so far that it's just too much of a leap of a faith. And so what we can do is we can start a new curve so that we can start to move up that curve so that when we need to make the leap, we don't have to go quite as far. Now, what does that new curve look like? If you know something else you want to do, and by the way, it's not always financial considerations, just so you know. I had one gentleman say to me he had 10 years of worth of savings in the bank, 10 years worth of savings, and he said, I still can't muster the courage and take a risk. So some of you may be thinking, well, if it were financial, it wouldn't be an issue. Maybe not. The fear may be an issue. So now, back to your question. So you say, I'm on this curve. I want to jump to a new curve. I think I know what I want to do. So you start doing that other thing very gradually. But the secret here is that other thing, if you don't have customers, you won't make time to do that other thing and let it become big enough that you can actually make the jump. And I'll give you an example. When I first started blogging, I thought, I want to blog. But we all know how it is. You're tired, it's Sunday night, you don't want to blog this week. But after I had 25 people, all my friends and family, following me on my blog, I knew that they were kind of counting on me to do it, so I had customers. So when I say customers, it's not necessarily someone who's buying a product. It's just someone who's counting on you, so there's an accountability for what you're doing on that new curve. And so that's what I would say is, know in your side yourself that you may have to do it so that you don't die inside a little, but in the meantime, start finding customers for that new curve so that you start making time to do it so that when it is time to jump, you can do it. Yes, please. Oh.
A I'll come to the mic and maybe it'll help. Hi, I'm Erin Horvath. I work for a large pharmaceutical distribution company. And about a year and a half ago, we created an innovation council. And a lot of executives from across the business units are represented there. And I got to tell you, we're really struggling getting it off the ground. So we meet on a monthly basis and we talk about great ideas, and we've matured a little bit to implementing some software. But any advice to maybe a group like that that may be struggling to try and take it to the next level or get the organization more involved with being more disruptive? Because historically mm-hmm. we're a very conservative company and we're looking to change that. So any advice?
Yeah. Great question. One of the things that happens when you're trying to disrupt is that so now I'm just going to take the advice that I just gave you and say, okay, you've got to start this little project on the side and get customers. But what happens is that little project on the side, you know, a lot of people within a large organization, they know what that little project on the side, their mandate is, and it's basically to kill the big beast, right? And so one of the things I would look at is, how do you get the people who are the senior people who are part of the Innovation Council, how do you dispel the fear factor for them as well? And in other words, help them think through and have ownership for these new ideas. And so there may need to be more work that needs to be done and trust building within this council so that they're not threatened, because that's probably what's going on. You have these great ideas, but no one implements them. Either because someone feels threatened, or they worry that they'll implement them and they won't get credit for them because someone will steal them. So there's actually no incentive whatsoever. So figure out what incentives there can be for these folks to be more innovative, understanding that at some level they understand that that innovation is meant to kill them. And so how do you make them feel like they won't actually get killed?
Great. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yes, please. Yes.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on how women create those external networks?
Yes. I'll give you an example from my own life. When I was at Merrill Lynch as a sell-side analyst, so I would write research to upgrade or downgrade a stock, and then I would ostensibly go through our sales force to then go to large financial institutions like Fidelity to share with them my ideas. That required that I worked within the internal power structure. But I found that the salespeople weren't actually that effective. And so I started to disintermediate them and create relationships with the investors themselves directly. So that instead of all of my power base residing within Merrill Lynch, I started to have really strong relationships with people at Fidelity, at Wellington, et cetera, such that my sandbox that I was playing in was actually this big, but the people who were in a part of the internal power structure, their sandbox was only this big. What that then meant is when I left Merrill Lynch, actually, well, this is when I was at Salomon Smith Barney. When I left Salomon to go to Merrill Lynch, my network was still intact because the people who were my clients were still my clients. And whereas some of those salespeople, their power was only domiciled within the organization. Did that answer your question?
It didn't.
Okay. Okay. The question was, how do women actually create those relationships from a tactical perspective externally? I think what you do is you say to yourself, okay, what is my job here that I need to get done? And what resources are available to me outside of my current context to make those done? So you start to think outside of the box. And in terms of developing those relationships, you start to look at, okay, well, who are some of the other more sort of peripheral stakeholders with whom I can get to know? And you figure out, well, what are their needs? What can I do for them? What are they trying to accomplish? And start to develop a relationship and a quid pro quo. Yes, please.
I just want to thank you, because from what you shared today, I realize I've been disruptive for many, many years.
Isn't that good to know?
Isn't that great?
Yeah, it is. It's helpful to understand, sort of see a pattern. Please keep going.
I left a successful business that I ran because I had passion. And my colleagues, my peers looked at me as if I was crazy. But I've created a very successful business today because I was willing to disrupt. And I thank you for sharing it, and I encourage every woman in this room to be disruptive.
All right, I don't know if you heard that, and I'll try to repeat it without sounding too self-aggrandizing. She said, thank you for sharing the story. You had your own successful business. You left it. People thought you were out of your mind for doing so, but then you started another business that has, again, become very successful. So went up the curve, jumped to a new curve, went up another curve, jumped to a new curve, went up a curve. And so the comment was just, thank you for giving me a pattern to actually describe the trajectory of my life. Yes, please. The question is, what do you do when you're at a firm that's fairly prestigious? You basically disrupt yourself to go do something more entrepreneurial, that you don't have a business card that you can say, I work at XYZ law firm or XYZ bank. And how do you deal with the fact that sometimes people get very condescending, like you're off to do some little pet project? I think the answer is, whenever you jump to a new curve, you actually get a lot of information about people and who you want to do business with in the future, because people will respond in very unexpected ways. Some of the people that you think will be very, very supportive of your daring to dream, in fact, are gone. Other people you hadn't ever anticipated were actually really part of your network, they're there for you. And so it's an opportunity to really kind of sift through your Rolodex and figure out, who's really my contact and who isn't? The other thing I would say is that when you disrupt yourself, and like I said earlier, you go to that place that you know you have to do it, there's this trust that comes inside of yourself that you start to know, I know that I'm on the right sort of trajectory for me. And so they may be kind of patting me on the head, but I know this is the right course. And then you just go out and you get really successful. And, you know, success is the best sort of revenge, even though we're not into revenge. Right. Should we do, yes, please.
I'm very favorable with mentoring, and I was wondering if you could share a story of a woman that mentored you, that you feel is a good female mentor for you.
Yes. The question is, I'm a big proponent of mentoring, and I'd like to know if there's a person who has mentored you, and if you could share that story. When it comes to women, there's a very interesting bifurcation that takes place. Sometimes people refer to women as being incredibly catty and competitive, and I think we've all had that experience of women being that way. I think that that only actually happens when you're in a place of scarcity, when you're trying to sort of get the attention, for example, of the other male partners, and there's two of you, and you know that if they pay attention to her, they probably won't pay attention to you. So I would say try to stay out of that situation. From a mentoring standpoint, but the other piece of it is that women also, I have found, can be incredibly, incredibly supportive of one another and want to give and help someone with a leg up. One example for me is a woman who's actually been, I haven't had as many mentors as I'd like, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I get it a lot from books that I read. And my friends end up mentoring me, but one woman in particular who's been a coach for many, many years has been a very, very valuable mentor to me. One thing you didn't ask, but I want to add, which I think is important, sometimes we think of mentoring as we find someone who's kind of this pseudo-parent that stays with us over 20 years, but I would love for you to revisit the idea of mentoring, and I wrote a piece on this called Get the Mentoring Equation Right. When you need a mentor, oftentimes it's because you've got something strategic that you need to figure out, or even tactical, to move up the curve just a little bit. If you can identify very clearly what that is you need to know, and then identify who you think that can teach it to you, then go to that person and say, my name is so-and-so, here's what I need to learn, I think you can teach it to me for X, Y, and Z reasons, would you be willing to spend a half an hour with me over the course of 3 months so that I can learn this, and then we'll be done. Most people, at least in my experience, when someone approaches me like that, I pretty much say yes every time because they know exactly what they want to learn. It's a limited scope project. They've realized that they want to learn it from me, and they've done the work to explain to me what they want to learn. And then after 3 months, it's done. And we can re-up if we want. But I think I think it's important to revisit how we think about mentoring, because the more you want someone to mentor you, it's probably the busier they are, and you've got to find a way to make it easy for them to do it. Yes?
You mentioned that instead of real life people, a lot of books were a good source of mentorship for you. Can you give us some?
Yes. The question is, you mentioned that rather than just real-life people, books have been a great source of mentoring for you. One book that I really loved is Katharine Graham's My History. She was the editor of the Washington Post. It is a fantastic, fantastic book. Another one is Barbara Corcoran, who many of you probably know who she is because she's on the Shark Tank. She wrote a book called If You Don't Have Big Breasts, Wear Pigtails, which was, of course, especially relevant to me. It's a really good book, and I think I find that very encouraging. So being able to read stories of, did I just turn that off? Maybe that means I'm supposed to stop talking. Yeah. Hello? No, it's off. Okay, I'll just project. So I think we've got to wrap up anyway. What I was going to say is that, does it just turn on?
I think so, yes.
We have about 5 more minutes. I said Barbara Corcoran. I said Katharine Graham's History. Those are the two that I'm thinking of immediately. I know who else I was going to say. This isn't so much a mentor, but a woman named Marjorie Williams, who is a writer for the Washington Post. She is a brilliant, she has died. She died of cancer several years ago, but she's a brilliant writer. And so being able to read profile pieces of people like Al Gore and Bill Clinton and George and Jeb Bush, I mean, just to hear her voice, that's a sort of mentoring. And so if you really broaden out the scope of what you think mentoring is, there's a lot to be learned from the people around you, even if you never actually meet them. The other thing, that I did once, is so I think Shane Battier is kind of awesome. He used to play for the Houston Rockets, and now he plays at the Miami Heat. And there was this whole article written about him by Michael Lewis, who wrote Liar's Poker. And he's called the No Stats All-Star. And so because he never had any stats that actually made it look like he was doing anything, and yet when he was on the court, everybody on his team played better and everybody on the other team played worse, but there were no stats to actually verify it. And so reading that was kind of a mentoring thing for me, because I realized that for women, oftentimes people have no idea what we're doing, and yet everything works better when we're around. And so that was kind of a mentoring thing for me, is to be able to read that and validate it. And so again, look for lots of different ways in which you can be mentored to learn the things that you want to learn. Okay, yes, please.
You talked about scarcity. Mm-hmm. I was wondering, or you mentioned it, I was wondering if you could talk about how scarcity affects your willingness to risk,
yes,
you know, to reinvent yourself, and then decisions you make along the way.
Okay, so you heard the question. It's about scarcity and our willingness to risk. And this goes back to your earlier question at your pharmaceutical company. When things feel scarce, we won't risk. We simply won't. We go into batten down the hatches, protect everything. And so what's important is when things feel scarce is to say to yourself, okay, I know that right now I'm in this scarce place of I just want people to tell me that I'm great and affirm me, and I don't feel generous toward anybody. We need to solve that problem first and really do some, and actually solve it. We solve it by being very, very kind to ourselves. Instead of looking at ourselves and saying, what is wrong with you? How come you're not being generous? How come you're not helping other people? What it's saying is, some needs that I have are not being met. I need to find a way to meet those needs. It may be that I need to just right now sit down and read a book for an hour. It may be that I need to take a nap. It may be that I need to go take a walk. It may be that I need to eat an ice cream cone. It means that if you're not being, your needs aren't being met, you cannot get out of your scarcity place. So my first advice to you, and actually that's going to be my only piece of advice, if you're feeling that things are really scarce, find a way to be kind to yourself. And that should even, kind not in a, oh, everything's awful, it doesn't matter anyway, but just like you would to a little child who is hurt or crying, and you're just really kind to them, and then things will start to feel like there's a little bit more available for us, and then we can start to problem solve the way we'd like to. All right, let's do one last question.
I've heard a little bit of women in disruption with business in your talk, mm-hmm. but my focus right now is having women disrupt the political agenda. There aren't enough women in politics. How do we empower women to realize that the way to change the system is to become the system?
Right. The question is, I've talked a lot about disruption in business, but her question is, how do you disrupt politics? How do you get more women to become involved in politics? I think that one of, actually interesting that you would ask that, there's a company out there called Popbox, which is about helping people who want to organize from a grassroots perspective and to be able to lobby. And I think that one of the ways to get women involved in politics is certainly a lot of us are just so disconnected from the process generally that why would we even consider running for office? But almost everybody has a cause that we care deeply, deeply about, whether it's education or healthcare, et cetera. So I think maybe a disruptive way to get more women involved is to have them understand and be aware of things like Popbox, where they can rally around a cause that is familiar and important to them, start empowering them and seeing that they can affect political change. And then you start to move people, I think, into a pipeline where they want to run for office. But I think there's such a wide gap right now. We've got to start to close that with really sort of incremental steps and starting where women are, and I think that's with a cause that they care about.
So it's
Pop Vox, like Voice of the People. Thank you so much.